I wanted to start with asking you about what you see coming down the pike for global economic trends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so each year we do a CEO survey of CEOs around the world, about 1,500 CEOs. And those CEOs today are telling us three things. One is there is cautious optimism over the next 12 to 24 months. That's driven by sort of three things. The U.S. continues to operate at a fairly good pace. It's a slow pace, but a good pace. Europe has lessened in terms of the severity of issues that are happening there, so there's a degree of confidence coming back. And the emerging markets, while slowing down, are still growing on a fast pace on a relative comparability around the rest of the world. So all of those things are really good in giving the CEOs a degree of confidence to make some more investments for a sustainable future. The second thing is they see increased consumer confidence and a willingness to spend. It's cautious, more cautious than the CEO's perspective, but nonetheless, it's there. And as a result, they're spending a tremendous amount of time and energy trying to think about how can I sell to the local consumer, which is causing them to be very focused on product innovation, local innovation, to make sure that they're customizing the service offering to their stakeholder group. And third is, how can I continue to be innovative and change what I am doing today to be more relevant tomorrow? And that innovation is coming from technology trends. It's coming from competitive landscapes that are operating faster than they are, and there's a catch-up mentality. Or it's coming from, and this is where I think the winners are coming out, a self-defined desire to radically change their business from where they are today to where they need to be 3 to 5 years from now. And most of your corporate community and your politicians are really trying to look at that defined timeline of 3 to 5 years. I can't control much more than that. How do I get there and how do I move forward?
And how do you think it relates to, say, New York State, the economy? We talk a lot about the economy here. You know, upstate obviously has struggled. Mm-hmm. Innovation is a buzzword because as corporate businesses have moved sort of out of upstate and manufacturing, innovation seems to be the key, some people think, to creating more jobs here. You know, how do you think those global trends relate to this state?
Yeah, I think New York State's at an interesting dichotomy right now. You've got things that are happening, you know, in the New York City-ish surrounding area where they are trying to not only redefine the city, but also continue to look for those areas of growth through continued innovation. And just to use one example, trying to mirror what Silicon Valley does and actually get tech houses to come in. And it's for purposes of innovation and creativity and new wave organizations to be resident in New York, but it's also to benefit how can they influence then other corporates in New York? So you've got a huge opportunity there for success that hopefully should drive it. When you look at the rest of the state, you are into, again, unfortunately, an interesting dynamic around the trends and what has impacted the upstate area. So this goes back to, are the consumers there? Are the employees there? Are the corporates there? And as you said, some of the corporates are retreating as they think about consolidation. They're thinking about tax implications. They're thinking about the ease of doing business. And one of the challenges in New York has always been, are there too many rules and regulations compared to other states that warrant manufacturing companies and other service companies to want to be there? So I think two things have to happen. One is the aspect of innovation in local businesses, small businesses that are prevailing in upstate New York, have got to continue to innovate and continue to try to grow from a local perspective. But the second area of innovation that's got to happen is actually our own governments. State, local municipalities have got to be more creative in terms of business of old rules, old laws, old tax requirements have got to change as well to remain relevant. Why? Because there's other states and now other countries that are willing to actually create a more interesting environment for our companies to want to invest and be. So it's not only an obligation of the corporates, it's actually an obligation of the state as well to be thinking about that stuff time and time again.
Are there specific things that you think New York State or other states in the U.S. should be doing in those areas to promote small, big, medium business growth?
Yeah, the U.S. economy has always thrived when that small, medium business opportunity has gotten the incentive to invest and has gotten the confidence to do it. So when you step back and ask the question, or what can be done, look, you look at any, I'll call it city, and you're looking for, do I have the right resources which come off of college campuses? Do you have the right incentives for people to want to stay, which is great place to work, which includes appropriate health care, appropriate logistics, appropriate education, appropriate recreation as well? And then do you have the motivation where government and business work together to actually create the next opportunity? What's the man on the moon statement that we want to make here, and where do we want everybody to work towards that makes it an unbelievable city for healthcare, or an unbelievable city for innovation in the technology space, or an unbelievable city that should be thinking about how do we connect with manufacturers more differently because we can leverage logistics coming off of the Great Lakes? There's lots of different things, but it's got to be a combined community, which is the community, government, and the business coming together to say, what do we want to be and what should we be over the next 10 years to take it to another place, and then really put the policies and procedures in place to get there.
You've mentioned that globally, cities are really where it's at, not necessarily countries, but getting cities that work and thrive. And you mentioned, you know, cities need to be involved in this in New York State. Do you think cities should maybe specialize in certain things like healthcare, or Albany has had the tech centers come and that sort of thing? Do you think that would help?
I do think that would help. I think it gives almost a guiding post to corporates that potentially want to go there, educators that are providing talent, and the government to put policies in place to try to move in that kind of direction. So it gives you this long-term relevancy and a determination and a focal point for people to then to strive for. If you're too diverse, too dispersed, then you're all about everything and standing for nothing. So I do think cities have to think long and hard about it. I'll give you one example outside of the States. We've got one location in Eastern Europe that wants to be a top 50 city in the next 20 years. And that's top 50 across the entire world. So they're thinking today about what is it that we will be known for. What's our reputation? How will we have the best recreation, the best education, the best healthcare, the best logistics to get in and out, the best ability to provide mobility and security, and how can we leverage data and technologies in ways that other cities don't do? And they have massive programs now thinking through that kind of stuff where the government and business are working together. And you see a big difference within the United States and within states within the U.S., where government and business probably aren't coming together as much as places outside the states where they do have a common goal. Today, we seem to be more at odds, and that's unfortunate because that doesn't do anybody any good.
And you mentioned universities and graduates and that sort of thing. You're a SUNY Oswego grad. Soon, we'll be getting a whole new class of seniors graduating from universities across this region. What are the things that you think make graduates successful?
Yeah, so we at PwC, PricewaterhouseCoopers, we're known for accounting, auditing, tax, and consulting. And the reality is we're a people machine because we're recruiting probably 10,000 students a year off campus. So it's right up our sweet spot. So what's making them successful is sort of three major components. One is they've got the smarts to be getting through school and coming into a place like ours. Second, they're able to lead. They have the great communication skills, the softer skills that are necessary to make it happen. Last but not least, they've got to have a intellectual curiosity or a passion for going above and beyond and doing A, the job that they've been asked, B, above and beyond the job they've been asked, and C, serve a higher purpose. And that gets back to the corporate responsibility agenda and the things that actually serve society as much as they do serving the corporate and the stakeholders they have to deal with. And today's next generation of students want to do that. So it's actually an obligation of the corporates, and for that matter, the governments, to make sure that environment's created so they can both do their day jobs and serve the larger societal purpose that's going on right now. And I think organizations or countries or cities or governments that do that well, I think you end up being a talent magnet. And as a result, then you'll have people want to be there, and that can gets to the growth issue, because then the more you've got talent, the more you've got consumer power. The more you've got consumer power, you've got growth potential going forward.
And you have mentioned that technology has really changed the way students need to prepare themselves for the work world. It used to be you had to have a certain knowledge base, but now with Google, you can get the knowledge base instantaneously. So what do students and educators teaching those students need to do to prepare?
You clearly need to be thinking about how do you prepare students to continue to work and aggregate information. Today, it doesn't all need to be in your heads. It actually has to be accessible, and that is accessible on a worldwide basis thanks to the internet and all the technology advances that have come. So you want to teach kids in college and in high school to figure out how do you do that in the most effective and efficient way possible. But what's really important is afterwards, how do you actually apply that knowledge? How do you put it into practice? How do you actually have an impact as a result of having that knowledge? And that's where I think universities got to continue to teach the behavioral aspects of what do you do with the knowledge that you have. In the past, we've tried to teach kids to have knowledge. Today, it's teaching them to get it and access it on a regular basis and continue to learn from it, but more importantly, apply it thereafter. So that experiential learning is huge. It's very easy as well, as you think about some of the societal issues that are out there right now. There are no rights and wrongs. There's a lot of choices, and the question becomes, what are the judgments and what are the values that should be applied against those judgments for students to do the right thing with a balance towards corporate enterprise and society overall, long-term versus short-term, individual goals versus team goals versus corporate goals versus city goals or state goals. And those are the judgments that you want to put kids into and get them to experience some things through some pilots, some test cases, some business cases, whatever the case may be. And that's the skill sets they're going to need going forward. The second big thing I would say, though, is kids got to continue to prove they're agile. The business world is changing rapidly. I can only predict probably 2 or 3 years of certainty. The job you will have today will still be there. It may radically change. And what we want to do is prove you can still be successful in a totally different world. So demonstrate you want to take on risk. You look for feedback and coaching and continue to develop. And those soft behavioral changes and the ability for you to grow and lead and continue to learn is really important as you look ahead.
Is it really more about learning how to be analytical and problem solve versus what the correct answer is?
I think there's an element of still what is the correct answer within a range, because there are many different answers to questions. Now you just need to understand the choices within and then why one choice is better than another. So to me, it's around the analytical skills, leveraging information. It's then how to apply it to come up with a range of alternatives and choices and then really understand the pros and cons in each one of those and then not necessarily listen to what maybe a constituency group or a demographic process would say the majority said X. Because you can think about many years ago, if Henry Ford went out to his consumer at the time and said, what do you want, you know, in a new vehicle or a new way to move around, everybody probably would say, I'd like a faster horse. Can you breed horses to be faster? What you're looking for is somebody to think about, forget the horse and buggy, get a motorized car and jump forward. 60% of the population probably wouldn't ever ask for the motorized car, but that's what we have today, and that's actually the next generation going forward. So you can't always listen to the populace. You got to do what you think is going to push the envelope of success going forward.
Back to innovation.
Yep.
What, as somebody who graduated from an upstate college and then succeeded to the highest levels of business, what would you tell someone graduating today?
I've had an opportunity, as I'm here on campus over the last 2 days, to meet with a lot of students that are starting the workforce over the next year or two. And what I've said to them is, number one, do your job well. You've been hired for a particular role. You want to make sure you do that extremely well. But that's a jacks or better baseline proposition to be in the game. That's an as expected performance. If you really want to succeed, you got to go above and beyond. You have to help others be successful. That shows great leadership. You've got to push the envelope of success. So not necessarily do the same old task the same old way. Come up with your own innovative way to think about things. And last but not least is learn. Continue to learn. As you come into organizations like PricewaterhouseCoopers or PwC, you've got the opportunity to connect with lots of other people that do lots of other things. And your challenge is to learn from them, be connected to them, because you may say to yourself a year or two from now, maybe the job I'm in today is not the one I want, but there's another opportunity. I now have created a huge network that can tap into that'll help me personally as well as professionally. So that's what I would focus on in your first couple of years getting into the workforce.
That's great. I want to pivot to your opinions about diversity and diversity in hiring. I've heard you say that you have to have the best talent and that diversity leads to that. Why is that true, that looking at a diverse pool of candidates leads to the best talent?
When I look at what we do at PricewaterhouseCoopers or PwC, our business imperative is to help solve problems and to provide assurance over information that people use. In order to have the best answers and therefore be seen as being the best and a leading professional services firm, you need to have a diverse group of people try to then solve that problem from many different facets. In order to do that, then you've got to have the best talent. And the only way you get the best talent is by having a diverse group of talent. When you look at the trends that are out in the workplace today and out in society today, there's a lot of different trends that point to the fact you have to be thinking more than your current state of thinking today. Everybody's thinking has a bias to it. It's because either how you grew up, how you were taught, how you learned, and how you experienced. But that's not the only way to think. There's other people that have other perspectives, other biases themselves. And by getting people in the room that have different perspectives, that usually means you can attack a problem from multiple different angles and then figure out what's the best path forward. So just go to, for example, an Eastern world versus a Western world way of thinking. It's really interesting to see the long-term nature of a Eastern world versus a short-term way of thinking in the Western world. Go to the male versus female, especially as you think about retail and consumer. A female perspective on how to package something is much different than a male's perspective on how to package something. And if you look at the data, the consumer purchasing power is sitting in women's pocketbooks, not the men's pocketbooks. So as a corporate, you want to be thinking about all aspects associated with that. But if you think about men becoming more involved with parenting today, then you got to be thinking about them more so, because you might have more women in the workforce, maybe some more men that are doing the shopping over the next 10, 20, 30 years. How do the men get involved in that? So that's why diversity is really important, to come up with the best answer for the problem in front of you. And I think diverse thinking and diverse people and perspectives is really important to get in the room to actually solve the problem.
And you've talked about Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In philosophy. What are your thoughts on what she's put out there for what women have done in the past in the corporate world and what they need to do?
So Sheryl's put forth, I think, an interesting and arguably innovative way to get the table back on the issue back on the table. And she puts, for the most part, the issue to the individual to say, make sure you don't lean out of opportunities, but whatever is important to you, make sure you lean into them. And I think that's a very important perspective that applies both to males and females. So this is not a gender issue. If you really read her book and listen to the messages, this is applying to everybody. The unfortunate fact is that we see it with academic studies and behavioral studies that it's more applicable to women, maybe because of the way women have been either raised, treated, or otherwise over decades or centuries. So I think it's a great proposition. What it is asking people to do is to make sure they lean into the opportunities to take advantage of what's important to them. But what is interesting is my counterview to that was organizations and others need to help as well. If someone's going to lean in, they potentially lean in and fall over. They need somebody to help prop them up. And I actually wrote a blog out there that talked about Sheryl's Lean In book, talked about how people should lean in, women should lean in. And what I said was the corporates have to lean in too to give them the support to be successful. And what you do is, how do corporates, for example, make sure the unconscious biases that may be in people's heads are trying to be minimized? How can you actually put programs in place to support women to lean in? And this is where you have to provide more flexibility programs. So when people and women particularly leave PwC, maybe they'll go have children, we have a program that allows them to leave but still stay connected to the firm and then come back in. Or women that are actually out on pregnancy leave, you're in a process where you'll be evaluated separately from the group. Why? Because there's an unconscious bias. When you're out of sight, out of mind, you might get evaluated a little bit differently. That's a reality. So you have to figure out programs and put programs in place to overcome the biases that may be there. And you got to coach people to do things differently. And last but not least, we put a program in place. It's actually called White Males as Diversity Champions. I think, unfortunately, some of the debate that is going on right now is there's great groups of women getting together to talk about Sheryl's book. Well, maybe the challenge is we don't need the women to get together. We need the men to get together. And if through the combination of the two, you're actually going to create the opportunities for everybody here. But the males have an equal role in that as much as the women do. Because what is really bad is if women lean in and if they're talking to a male counterpart, if they don't catch them, they're falling. So there's got to be equal effort on both sides for the diversity and inclusive agenda to be successful in any organization in any city. And where what's really interesting is, and I apologize for going on a little bit longer on this topic, but clearly passionate about it, corporates do this stuff today. The question is, are cities doing enough about this today? Are mayors and governors and state officials, elected officials, really doing enough around what is the look and feel of their states, their cities, their counties, and bring these kind of issues to life through the combination of working with business communities, small business, large business, et cetera, but are they doing enough as well?
So you really think, in addition to sort of the person-to-person, whether it's men or women, helping people lean in, that there are corporate or governmental larger things that can be done to help?
Absolutely. You can go into some cities in this country where you can walk into a business meeting that's been organized by the mayor, and it's all white males sitting around the table. That's a missed opportunity, and you really got to put yourself in somebody else's shoes walking in and say, why is this, and what are you all doing about this? And it can't be a one-to-one conversation. One-to-one helps, but there's got to be a bigger program to say, hey, guys, let's really get serious about some of these things. Now, I'm not for more rules and regulations, because I think that's one of the challenges CEOs have today is managing all the rules and regulations. But I do think there's way to put some, you know, aspirational programs in place to help diversify cities and counties and states that actually help from a benefit perspective. What people have missed is there is a big business opportunity here as you think about this concept of diversity, which creates more opportunity for people. That creates more success. More success usually means more purchasing power through more compensation. That helps states and cities actually be more successful as GDP growth grows in those areas.
If you relate it back to upstate, if you have, well, any community, if you have women or minorities not benefiting from success, then they can't participate fully in the economy.
That's right. That's exactly right. And that's where, again, our corporates, the local chamber of commerce, and our elected officials have to be thinking about what's the challenge that we have in front of us. And if one of the issues is how do you continue to grow as upstate New York, how do you think about, well, let's break that down into some component pieces. And first off, who's living here? And then how are we going to enable their individual success? And if one of the elements is we've got women, minorities, et cetera, that are here, how are we doing something to enable their individual success? Because their success then defines the success of upstate New York.
More women are going to college these days than men. But then when you get to the higher leadership positions, that percentage goes down mm-hmm. quite a bit. And I guess the question is, you know, Cheryl talked about, you know, sort of there was a plateauing of women rising up. I mean, are you seeing that change at all a little bit since this conversation began, or is it too early?
I think it's too early to see the impact of it. What has really been successful post her book launch was the amount of conversations that are happening. So the awareness is going up dramatically. The good news as well is think about the number of CEOs, women CEOs, that have been put in place at places like Yahoo and GM and other places like that in the last couple of, you know, last year or two, which has been great. But there's still a heck of a lot more to be done in this space where that middle management is continuing to get opportunities and not getting squashed down and continuing to create the opportunities for upper senior positions and influence. And to me, that's a huge potential. But the efforts right now, I think, are just underway and the results are yet to be seen.
You mentioned early on that it's hard to predict more than sort of 3 or 5 years out. But whether it's diversity or economic trends globally or here in the U.S., what is it you, not that you think you will see, but what is it you would like to see 5 years down the road happening in corporate America or corporations around the world?
In our survey, we ask the CEOs to be thinking about what are the most important trends that will have real impact on their business over the next 3 to 5 years. And we give them 5 choices. And it was some things that we have been talking about. We've talked about it here on campus. One is around changing demographics. Second, about the concept of urbanization. Third is about the shifting of economic powers to places outside of the U.S. Fourth is the issue about resource and resource scarcity. And fifth is about technology. In the U.S., 86% of the CEOs we interviewed would have the technology advances being the number one issue that they are focused on. What is scary is that 2/3 of them don't feel their individual IT organizations are actually prepared to deal with the changes that are coming. So that new world order that has an implication on business in terms of how quickly it can change and it can be disrupted, how we communicate with one another through the use of social media and or otherwise, and the implications of how we remain competitive as a country are really important and influenced by technology. I hope over the next 5 years or so we see 2 major things. One is that the U.S. continues to be seen as an innovative leader and a role model for the rest of the world. I think we've lost that over the last couple of years. Second is that we have Congress and those on the Hill down in D.C., and the business community more working together. Because today, unfortunately, we're still at odds with one another. And it doesn't feel like when I travel around the rest of the world, a couple other countries where businesses and governments are working together right now, it is creating a huge potential for that country and the people within it and a huge willingness for others outside that country to come in and want to do business. And that's where the U.S. has got to be seen as being advantageous to a global world and inviting an attractiveness for allowing the rest of the world to come back in again today.
You mentioned technology, and STEM education is the buzzword these days, I think particularly in upstate New York. But what do you think that really is where students of today need to focus?
I do think that's an element of it. I don't want to minimize any of the other arts and sciences. And this is where, and thankfully I'm not in public office, but if I were, the thing that was amazing is go back to the 60s when Kennedy said we want to put a man on the moon in the next X number of years. And the amount of collective focus on getting that done by the government and business was not only impactful in getting a result of getting somebody on the moon, but creating a sense of urgency towards new and different ways of thinking about things and solving problems. And there was a whole bunch of tangential benefits from that. We got new technologies as a result of it. We advanced the computer age significantly to try to enable it. The science and STEM type skill sets were huge as an enabler to that. You need to continue to do all of that today. And that's why I said earlier, you know, do you have that focal point as a country? We want to be known for our healthcare, or we want to be known for XYZ in innovation, or we want to be known for XYZ in technology. Thankfully, we still have that today, but others around the world are catching up. So STEM is usually important, but we can't forget about some of the other disciplines out there as well.
It sounds like the passion quotient is important no matter what.
Absolutely. And you want to be in a perspective, and I've got the benefit here of traveling around the world and around the country. We've got to make sure that we, the United States, are sustainable and relevant to a global economy. And that today is more important than ever before. The smallest business that may be operating in upstate New York is probably still connected globally. Why? Because they're leveraging the internet to sell anywhere around the world today. Or whatever they may be selling, maybe have some element of a supply chain coming from around the world today. Or maybe the technology they're using today comes from somewhere outside of the U.S. borders. So the connectivity is huge. We have to remain relevant as a country and a group of cities within the country to the rest of the world, and can't be seen as isolationist, or can't be seen as a place where, well, the U.S. is dead. Thankfully, the U.S. is not dead. In that same CEO survey, the number one place this year to invest was the U.S. That hasn't happened in the last couple of years. You've always seen the U.S. as being number two, typically behind China. But U.S. became number one this year in the CEO survey because of the resiliency of the U.S., which comes from a really quality workforce that comes from a quality education. Second is a consumer base that's fantastic and continuing to grow, albeit at a slow pace. And third is a degree of resiliency and a rule of law that we have here that other countries don't have. So that benefit is important, but it doesn't take much to change that in a world where other countries want to take that spot. And it's a really competitive world out there that our people need to be more focused on.
Great. Well, I could probably talk to you all day, but I have gotten all my questions answered. Was there anything else you wanted to talk about?
Listen, this is a great opportunity for people, particularly this time of year, for those that are on campus to be thinking about what they do on campus and once they graduate from campus and the like. And I wanted to make sure that people understand two things. There's a tremendous need for people with relevant skill sets and a passion for actually contributing to their cause. And that goes to the corporates. So you're a wanted commodity. Students today are a wanted commodity because there's not enough to fill the jobs that we have and the relevant skill sets that are needed. So that's great. But you just got to make sure you take advantage of the opportunity once you get there. And second is you can never lose the itch for giving something back. Today, many corporates do as much as they possibly can because the individuals want to do as much as they can. Governments are cutting way back when you think about the fiscal deficit issues that are out there today. The number one issue CEOs are worried about is how the government responds to all of the deficits that have been created over the last 5 years. So philanthropic activity has been reduced. Hospital and education for hospitals has been reduced because there's not as much charity going forward. So those organizations can only do so much, and there's less dollars going to them. So what we look for is the next generation, our talent, our next generation of leaders, our future politicians, our future presidents, CEOs, and the like. You've got to give back more than just your day job. And that would be the other message I leave out to everybody out there, no matter how young or old you may be, is make sure you can give back. That could be financially a dime or a dollar or hundreds or thousands of dollars. It doesn't matter. Your contribution is important. And second is your time. your ability to think, your ability to influence something. Don't ever lose that perspective that you can influence a person or a body of people, and your voice really counts. So get engaged, get involved, and try to make a difference.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us
today. Happy to be here.
Thank you.